From NPR in the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Felix Contreras, sitting in for Maria Hinojosa. It may sound like the setup for a joke, but is the Pope Latino?
This is a conversation that's ongoing in the Latino community. You know, we're always navel-gazing about our own identity and who we are.
We figure it out with the help of our friend Victor Landa, editor of News Taco. Next, from San Diego to Tucson to Austin, rising controversies over Chicano studies.
By not having the opportunity to have a different perspective, then students miss out. It would be like going to a school where the only way to understand biology is through creationism.
And get ready to mosh to the punk norteño sounds of piñata protest.
It's chaotic and people are bumping into each other, but they're having so much fun.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Felix Contreras. Stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Felix Contreras, sitting in for Maria Hinojosa. To check in on the news of the week, we've invited back Victor Landa, editor of News Taco. To fill us in on what's going on out there, he joins us from San Antonio, Texas. Welcome back to Latino USA, Victor.
Glad to be here, Felix.
Okay, many of us are just about done talking about the new Pope, Pope Francis. But the Associated Press published a story recently which asked, is the Pope Latino? Now, the question came up, because although the Pope, whose real name is Jorge Bergoglio, is from Argentina, his parents are from Italy. Now, what is the source of the confusion, and does it matter whether we call the Pope Latino?
You know, I think this was one of those curiosity pieces that comes up every once in a while. And Associated Press caught on to this story because there was some chatter on social media going on with some Latinos that, you know, and the Latino community is always doing this navel-gazing about our own identity. You know, what is it to be Latino and language and colorism and all these other things. And it just kind of flared up a little bit when this Latin American cardinal was elected Pope and these questions were coming up. But, you know, this is just a sliver of a conversation that's ongoing in the Latino community. You know, we're always navel-gazing about our own identity and who we are and what's it like, especially in the U.S. Latino community. I sort of look at it as a curiosity piece of non-Latinos peering in to this robust conversation that's always going on in the Latino community, right?
Okay, now another interesting tidbit about Latinos and identity that popped up this week came up in an interview that pop singer Bruno Mars gave to the magazine GQ. In the article, the singer, whose given name is Peter Gene Hernandez, talked for the first time about why he stopped using his Puerto Rican father's last name. What did he say, Victor?
But he said that it had to do with the business that he was in. And actually, when he started singing, he was being pegged as a Latino singer, and he didn't want to be that. I think that was during the days of, you know, the heyday of Enrique Iglesias, and he didn't want to be another Enrique Iglesias. And he wanted to be as far removed from that kind of an identity as possible. So Bruno Mars was the name that he picked.
You know, I think it's interesting, too, because immediately I went back to maybe as far back as Anthony Quinn, the actor Anthony Quinn, who was Antonio Reyes, Martin Sheen, who was Ramon Estevez. In those days, there was quite a hurdle to overcome if you didn't change your name. And it's interesting that he felt like he had to change his name in these days with Jennifer Lopez, Rita Moreno even, or Edward James Olmos.
Yeah, but that's not so different from other people changing their names for stage names. You know, it sort of plays into that whole stage name and Hollywood name kind of thing. And his was wanting to change his identity because he did not want to be pegged as a Latino singer. So
I guess eventually it all comes down to the talent and what he has to offer. And from where I sit, man, that guy can sing.
Right. I agree.
But we're going to turn again to the goings-on here in Washington. Now, we've been keeping an eye on diversity among Obama appointments and nominations.
Yes.
And there was one person who caught our eye, though he does not have a marquee position. His name is Miguel Rodriguez. Now, who is he and why is this appointment significant?
This is a big, big, big appointment. He is the director of legislative affairs for the Obama administration in the White House. So he's basically the Congress wrangler. He's the one that goes for the president and tries to get Congress to go along with the president's legislative agenda. And the thing is that he may not be known in Congress, at least his name isn't a household name, but it's not a new name. He worked for Hillary Clinton when she was in the State Department. He was doing pretty much the same thing for her. He was her Congress wrangler or Congress whisperer, as some people say, overseeing the State Department's relations with the Senate. So he's been around. I mean, he's done this before. So this isn't new to him, although his name seems to be new to us.
And according to the Washington Post article that we read, a lot of Republican legislators and aides and staffers aren't really familiar with his name as it relates to being a wrangler of sorts with Congress from the administration. But someone pointed out that that's probably a good thing because he doesn't have any baggage representing an administration with lots of baggage from the first term.
Right. And it's almost like a clean slate, starting off the second Obama administration with a brand new legislative liaison, I think might be a good thing. And it might bode well for the president's legislative agenda moving forward. So, yeah, it could be a good thing that nobody knows him, or at least that they say that they don't know him, especially as we're looking at the immigration issue and trying to reach some sort of agreement and deal with immigration. Him being the son of immigrants, I believe his mother is from Chile and his father is from Colombia. So he has a very personal interest and stake in making sure that this immigration reform is something that happens smoothly and as quickly as possible.
I think that's all the time we have for that today. Thank you, Victor.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, Felix.
Victor Landa is the editor of News Taco. He spoke to us from San Antonio, Texas. Ethnic studies programs have been in the news recently. In California, San Diego State University announced they were experiencing a decline in enrollment for their Chicano Studies department at the same time as enrollment of Latino students overall on the campus is climbing. Meanwhile, in Arizona last month, a federal judge ordered the Tucson School District to implement, quote, culturally relevant courses, end quote, in order to end segregation. Courses much like the high school Mexican-American studies program that Arizona lawmakers banned last year. Now, to help us understand these two situations is Alex Zaragoza. He's professor of history in the Department of Comparative Ethnic Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. He joins us from the Journalism School at UC Berkeley. Alex, welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you very much, Felix.
Now, Alex, you started teaching Chicano Studies at Fresno State in 1969, and in the interest of full disclosure, I must tell our listeners that I was one of your wide-eyed freshman students back in 1976. And, you know, we were largely second and third generation in this country from Mexico. Now, fast forward about 20 years, and I was teaching a class at Fresno State, and I was surprised by the number of Spanish-dominant immigrant or first-generation students. Now, does that change in demographic have anything to do with why San Diego State may be experiencing a drop in enrollment for their Chicano Studies program?
Well, I think it could be a factor, but I think to focus just on San Diego State, we lose sight of the tremendous variations among so-called Chicano Studies programs, many of which have very different titles, in fact, that in the past were lumped together as Chicano Studies. So we have everything from Mexican American Studies, which is the case at San Diego State, to La Raza Studies, Chicano Latino Studies, Hispanic Studies, and variations thereof. But I think the enrollment figures may or may not reflect the situation at San Diego State.
So that particular issue is restricted strictly to that campus and how they interpret the numbers.
I would argue, yes. I mean, there are many campuses where enrollments are going up or have held steady as opposed to declines. And as the article indicated, that decline is not sudden. It's been going on for 2 or 3 years. It's just that at a certain point, they reached their threshold of not meeting their quote-unquote enrollment target. There are very few campuses where if it's, say, 40% of the student body is Latino, that translates automatically into a 40% representation of Latino students in the courses in the Chicano Studies program.
San Diego officials claim that part of the reason for the drop in enrollment is largely an issue of self-identification. In other words, fewer students were self-identifying as Chicano, according to officials on the campus, and they don't really see a need to enroll in Chicano Studies classes. Is that something that you've seen as the demographic changes over the years?
I would suggest that change in identity is not the key factor as to what might be going on at San Diego State. I think there is a demographic aspect to it, that is the surge in Mexican migration. But there's many other factors, I think, that are at play, let us say. Chicano studies programs in Southern California have a different tone, if you will, than those in Northern California, and similarly the case in, say, the San Joaquin Valley of California, such as Fresno State. You compare the courses that are available in and around California, for example, to what's offered at the University of Texas at Austin, and you have still another variation on the theme. I think also some curriculum have not, let us say, adapted and adjusted to the demographic changes, nor adapted and adjusted to the different interest among students of Latin American background, those of Mexican background in particular, or what we used to often refer to, lump them all together as Chicanos.
So to be clear, what's happening at San Diego State is not part of a trend that you've seen anecdotally around the country.
No, I have not. And generally speaking, I have not seen a decline overall. If anything, it's been holding steady and, depending on the campus, in some cases, a big increase.
Let's move on to the high school situation in Tucson. What does it do to a community when a ban like Tucson's takes effect? I mean, what do these students miss out on?
By not having access or not having the opportunity to have a different perspective, let us say, on those kinds of questions, then students miss out. It would be like going to a school where the only way to understand biology is through creationism or something of that sort. And while that may be exaggerating the distinction, the fact remains that without that perspective, students don't have a robust view in which to understand very basic ideas about how we tell the story of the United States, whether it's politically, economically, socially, or culturally.
And finally, another question for Chicano Studies on campus is, as the way people identify themselves changes, as it has at San Diego State, but also as there are more and more inter-ethnic marriages and Latino heritage mixed with other cultures, you know, what happens there?
I'm fairly optimistic about the future of Chicano Studies, regardless of trends of greater intermarriage, both between Latinos and non-minority groups, but also within and among minority groups as well. Among the reasons for that is there's always a proportion of students that want to understand the persistence of discrimination, racism, nativism, and the recent flare-up around immigration issues plays to that. But again, I think Chicano studies, like almost any field, has to adapt and adjust to the changing population, to the changing needs of students, to the changing questions that students ask about themselves, their parents, and their relationship, in this case, to American society.
Dr. Alex Zaragoza is a professor of history in the Department of Comparative Ethnic Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Felix.
And now a note about two stories we aired recently. The first was about a special driver's license in North Carolina that would have added a pink stripe to identify young immigrants with deferred action status. The state has decided to abandon the special color coding. And regarding our story about past discriminations against Hispanic farmers and ranchers by the Department of Agriculture, the deadline for filing a claim against the agency has been extended to May 1st of this year. Coming up on Latino USA, playing your parents' music doesn't always get their approval.
My mom walks to the door and she's like, ay Dios, no. She was freaking out, you know.
We talk with Álvaro del Norte, lead singer and accordion player from the band Piñata Protest. That's coming up, no se vayan.
Trompeta y el trombón que van a conversar. We'll be right back.
Every March, tens of thousands of music fans converge on Austin, Texas for the annual South by Southwest Music Festival, where music takes over a town that likes to call itself the live music capital of the world. In my role as co-host of NPR's Alt Latino, my job is to go down there and find the newest and coolest music and bands. And every year, there's always one band that just completely blows me away. This year, it was Piñata Protest from San Antonio, Texas. Okay, there's nothing wrong with your radio or your MP3 player. That is indeed Norteño Punk, played by the four young Chicanos of Piñata Protest. They have an album coming out in May, but we wanted to get to them after South by Southwest to give us a preview of their upcoming album. With us today from San Antonio Public Radio Station KSTX is the lead singer and main writer for the band, Álvaro del Norte. Álvaro, welcome to Latino USA.
Hi, glad to be here.
Now, I'm not going to ask what inspired you to combine Norteño and punk, but instead tell us a little bit about your life as a teenager in Texas and how those two genres influenced you.
Well, I grew up mainly in very conservative Mexican family. They played a lot of Norteño, a lot of Tejano all the time. I honestly hated it when I was younger. When I was a teenager, I also got into punk rock. You know, all those great bands, The Clash, The Ramones. You know, I really wanted to get away from what my parents did.
That's a theme that's common to a lot of people here, because I basically went through the same thing, pushing aside the mariachi, the norteño. But when you came up, the punk scene had already established itself and, in fact, had grown and developed into a genre. At what point did you put the two magically together, and did it hit you at an aha moment where it's like, this could work?
It happened when I was in my college years. I think I was doing a lot of soul searching around that time. And at that time, too, I had become really frustrated with all the bands I've ever played in. I played in all sorts of bands, a Tejano band, punk rock bands, hardcore bands, all kinds. You know, I wanted to create something different, something myself. And the only thing I can really come up with was my love for punk rock and my newly discovered love for Norteño and Tejano music.
At the start of the interview, we heard your version of La Cucaracha, which I have to say killed the crowd when I saw you guys on the Thursday night there at the Karma Lounge. Now, there are a few other cover songs on your upcoming album, and there are some original songs. So let's play a little bit of Tomorrow Today, and then you can tell us about the song.
Tomorrow we'll regret today.
Okay, I hear a waltz in there. One, two, three, one, two, three. But I've never really heard a waltz played like that before. Tell us about the song. Who wrote the song and what is it about?
I wrote this song, and I wrote this song about one of my great friends of mine who lives also in San Antonio and just describes one of our nights out at the main music strip in San Antonio and having too much to drink and, you know, just being livid the whole night and not regretting it, just going all out and being crazy.
You mentioned how you discovered and you got into Norteño playing as a matter of necessity, essentially. But
yeah.
We should remind listeners that San Antonio's like ground zero for conjunto and accordions, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's got a long tradition going back. And as a matter of fact, just recently you guys played the Tejano Music Awards fanfare at the Market Square in San Antonio. Now, how did the crowd react to the band and the music?
It was great. Everybody, for the most part, seemed to enjoy our show, if not be at least entertained by it, our freak show, essentially. I really enjoyed watching the viejitos, the veterans of Tejano music, and watching their reaction. You know, some of them, I think, shaking their head like, what is this guy doing, you know? And then you have this crowd of people just dancing. And to me, I see it as like a mosh pit, actually, of people just dancing around these couples. And it's chaotic, and people are bumping into each other, but they're having so much fun.
Before we go, I got to ask you, what do your parents think of the music now?
I remember when I got my first guitar, putting it into my tiny little amplifier, and it just rang out through the house. And my mom walks to the door, and she's like, ay Dios, no. She was freaking out, you know. You know, but now the way that the band's going, you know, we're progressing, we're playing bigger shows, and they've certainly become more accepting of it, which is great.
Yeah, maybe they'll come around and start dancing the mosh pit with you guys. Álvaro del Norte is the lead singer and accordion player from the band Piñata Protest. Their new album, Valiente, is coming out in May, and he joined us today from KSTX in San Antonio. Álvaro, thank you, and good luck to you and the guys in the band.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Last week, a master of Cuban music died. Bebo Valdez was 94 years old and died of complications from pneumonia near his home in Sweden. His record producer says that even as Valdez struggled with Alzheimer's in recent years, he played piano every day, sometimes reaching all the way back to his days as a young boy, hearing concerts by Cuban pianists trained in the late 19th century who bridged the country's African culture and European piano tradition. Another Cuban pianist once told me he cried when he finally met Bebo. He says what you hear in Bebo's music is the entire history of the Cuban piano, from the Western classical sounds of the colonial period to the jazz music of the 1920s and 30s, to the development of the mambo and Havana dance halls in the 40s and 50s, and even after he left Cuba in the 60s and for three decades labored in obscurity in European hotel piano bars, his influence was felt in the development of salsa and Latin jazz. 8 decades after he started playing piano, Bebo Valdez was greeted at every performance with an ovation of such genuine affection that it brought me close to tears when I had a chance to see him perform. His long, slender fingers gracefully reached back in time through music. We close today's show with Bebo Valdez playing an Afro-Cuban classic, La Comparsa, from an album of solo piano called simply Bebo. And for this week, that's Latino USA. If you have any comments or suggestions, please call our listener line at 646-571-1228. You can also friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, where we are Latino USA, all one word. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Andres Caballero, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Janaea Williams, and Michael Jones. We had production help this week from Michael Simon Johnson and Melanie Bocuse at NPR New York. Latino USA is produced by the Futuro Media Group in Harlem. The program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm Felix Contreras. Maria Hinojosa will be back next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is funded in part by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com. And the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business and Executive MBA program at Yeshiva University. This is NPR.